probably don't remember me because it was kind of a big party, but I did meet you briefly at a party for Mary on the occasion of her novel.
Uh-huh.
It was thrown by Charlotte Chandler.
Right, yes. Yeah, that was a good party.
Yeah, that was a nice party. And so that's where I first ran into you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good to meet you in person and have a chance to talk to you more directly. I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
It was. I started the book on Saturday, and I finished it on Saturday.
Oh, good. That's a good sign.
I think I quit in the middle just briefly to do some personal business, but then I got back to the book, and you know, it's one of these books that it's really hard to put down.
I do that deliberately, or try to. I try to write a book that can't be put down.
I don't know of anyone else
who does that. I think that's one of the reasons.
Well, one of the reasons you're able to do it is that, one, you have short scenes that it's almost like a motion picture. You can see these scenes unveiling very much like a motion picture. And you write easily with short sentences, so you communicate very directly, and so there's no vagueness here.
Yeah, I write visually because all my training since I was 17 years old when I began writing movies has been for the dramatic form of the arts as opposed to the narrative form. So my books are very visual because I've been trained to think that way and write that way.
You wrote a thriller, Windmills of the Gods, and like many thrillers, there are some implausibilities. So what you do when you read thrillers, for the most part, you just kind of don't think about it and
no,
just
get caught up in
the book.
If you feel there are implausibilities, I would like to know what they are.
Oh, well, they're not major. They're nothing.
Even minor.
It's nothing.
Because I don't.
Nothing that would stop the pace of the book.
No. But, give me an example.
Well, the Mary, for example,
mm-hmm.
Has not been confirmed, but she sells her house or rents her house in Junction City, Kansas.
Right.
And goes and stays in a $250 a day hotel in Washington. And she hasn't been confirmed. Now, I don't think that somebody who is still going through the confirmation progress would burn her bridges behind her. I think she would hold on to the house and maybe fly to Washington for the confirmation hearings, but hang on for a bit before.
Don't forget that Stanton Rogers told her that the confirmation was a formality, and she accepted that. We discussed that at length, Mary and I.
Well, I know, but you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen in Congress. There's a thriller that I read last week, written by a very nice writer. His name is Martin Gross. He wrote The Red President. I don't know if you've had a chance to.
No, I haven't.
And in some respects,
is it a new book?
Brand new book, and it has the same kind of international intrigue that you have here. And what he does, he has the vice president confirmed in an emergency session in 6 hours by the Senate. Well, now you know that.
That sounds fast. But
it is very,
in an emergency
fast.
Situation, who knows?
And the Senate is not told why it's an emergency, but you have to take our word for it. It's an emergency, and you must approve the vice presidential nomination immediately, and they do. Well, no, that's an implausibility.
Yeah.
But still, while I knew it intellectually,
the story carried you along.
The story.
But I work very hard. I do a lot of rewrites. I will rewrite my books for up to a year and a half of rewrites. I'll do a dozen total rewrites. So I don't want any implausibilities left in my book. I try to cover all that thoroughly. That's why I'm interested in what you feel are implausibilities. I try not to have any and not to let the narrative carry it along. I don't think that's right. I think it should be perfectly logical.
Well, now that has to be a very minor observation, not even a complaint, the one I just cited, out of sheer practicality.
Okay, I'll accept.
Even though that you have set it up and to try to justify that, you know that nobody is going to take it for granted that he or she is going to be confirmed for high office. I mean, it's just.
I'll accept.
But it didn't really make any difference. I mean, I knew this intellectually. I didn't even dwell on it. I mean, it was just back there in my mind. But the narrative.
Were there other things?
Oh, there were a couple of things. I didn't write them down. There were a couple of little things, but they were so minor that. One thing I wish you had changed. I don't want to come on heavily because I'm not a Mike Wallace and I celebrate the book and I don't criticize it. But the arsenic that Sam
is feeding her.
Sam, right?
Mike Slade.
Is giving her in the coffee. I wish that had been done. I wish she hadn't done that. because he's on her side, and you don't know how people are going to react to arsenic, even in small amounts. It could have been fatal, and it didn't. That didn't seem right. I wish there had been a better way to get the arsenic into her.
Well,
maybe
it came,
the French
came,
doctor.
It came from a doctor. I mean, I checked. I check everything. I research everything thoroughly, and this was medically given to me as a way to do it. The antidotes were given to me as the antidotes that would stop anything serious from happening. So that's all, you know, medically correct.
But
as
the,
far as
the motivation of it, I mean, the,
well, the motivation is to get her sick enough to get the hell out of there and go see a doctor away from an Iron Curtain country.
All right,
as you know,
all right, you've explained that. One thing I really liked was the description about what it was like to be an ambassador without any previous experience and all the errors and mistakes. Now, I had no idea that there is a certain form that an ambassador goes about certain people that he sees or she sees.
Oh, the protocol is rigid.
Why didn't she have help with that?
Well, they gave her what help they could, but I mean, on her own, she's seeing the city, and she goes there. She passes her any embassy, says, "Oh, I'm going to go in and introduce myself." I mean, you never do that. No, I spent time in, first of all, in researching this book, when I decided my heroine was coming from a small town, I went to the map on the wall of my office, and I picked out a place in the center of the United States, Junction City, Kansas, called the editor of the newspaper. He sent me copies of the paper. Chamber of Commerce sent me the booklets, pamphlets on the town. Chamber of Commerce. I read it all. And when I'd read all the material, I couldn't smell the town. I had to get on a plane, two airplanes, and fly to Junction City. I spent a week there. And when I left, I was able to write about the city. I went to Romania for 10 days, spent time with the ambassador there. Went to Washington, talked to senators, ambassadors, ex-ambassadors. I researched everything in enormous detail. If I write about a meal in a Washington restaurant or a Singapore restaurant, I've had that meal at that restaurant, or I don't write about it.
Yeah, you really did your homework.
I do all my books.
Yeah, that's for sure. And my wife felt very much the way I did. She also could not put the book down. And she read it. She's a little slower than I am. So it took her 2 days.
Well, you read a lot of books, don't you?
Yes, I do.
I think you'd have to.
Yeah, yeah.
So you think? Would you like a throat lozenge?
No, I don't. I don't need that.
Would you care for anything, madam?
We're on tape. I take the material incidentally and edit it very finely. And so
we'll be on for half an hour.
We just chat and then I cut it and edit it. And
we haven't started yet. Have we?
Yeah. Well, yes, we have.
Really?
Well, everything is on the record. So tell me a little bit about you and how it all began for you, because you started in the motion picture business.
Right. I was 17 when I went to Hollywood to be a screenwriter.
Where did you grow up?
Chicago. And I came to New York when I was just 17. I wanted then to be a songwriter. And I got a job. It was during the Depression. I got a job with the RKO Jefferson on 14th Street as an usher. I worked there morning so I could spend afternoons talking to publishers in the Brill Building uptown. And before that, in Chicago, I had worked in check rooms, hanging hats and coats, while I was working my way through school. And I wrote a song in Chicago. And that was the days of the big bands that played cross-country before television. And the orchestra leader at the Bismarck Hotel, where I was working in the check room, was Phil Levant. I wrote this song and asked him, as he was passing by one evening, if he would mind looking at it. He looked it over, came back to me and said, "I'd like to have an orchestration made. I'd like to play it." And I was thrilled. So every night from then on, while I was hanging hats and coats from around the corner in the big ballroom, I would hear my song being played. It was called My Silent Self. And I decided that I was really Irving Berlin. So I wrote 12 more songs, told my mother and father I wanted to go to New York to be a songwriter. Came to New York, lived at the YMCA. Got a job at the RKO Jefferson's and usher. Went uptown to the Brill Building, and all the publishers asked me the same thing. What have you had published? And I said nothing, and they said, "Come back when you've had something published." It was Catch 22. After 6 months of this, I decided I really wanted to write for movies. And that's when I went to Hollywood. I got a job as a reader and began getting up very early in the morning before I went into Universal, where I was working.
Now, when you were 17?
I was 17
and
years old.
They hired you as a reader?
Yes. What happened was...
You must have been a very precocious teenager.
Well, what happened was that I went around to the then 8 major studios, and I said to the policeman at the gates, "My name is Sidney Sheldon. I would like to be a writer. Whom do I see?" And they all said the same thing: nobody. I could not get in the gates. And my mother had given me 4 weeks to get a job in Hollywood or to come back to Chicago. It was the heart of the Depression. She wanted me with her. And I heard about a week before I was due to go back home, I heard about readers, people who synopsize books for busy producers. So I sat down and wrote a synopsis of Steinbeck's marvelous book of Mice and Men. And I sent a copy to all the studios. And within 2 days, I heard from every one of them. Universal hired me. And I would get up at 4 or 5 every morning and work on my own original stories. I wrote 4 without selling any. The 5th one sold, then the other 4 sold. And I was established as a screenwriter. I was then 18.
Did they use your screenplay of Mice and Men?
Oh, no, it wasn't my screenplay. I just did a synopsis to show them what
right.
I could do.
It was a synopsis.
It was just a sample.
A sample, yep,
yes.
That's right. But ultimately, of course, it was filmed.
It was filmed, but it had nothing to do with me.
Oh.
It was my entree. You know, to get into Hollywood, they keep screaming they need new talent, and they do. At the same time, those huge gates are up to keep people out. So it's very hard for talent to become recognized. You need what I would call a Trojan horse. You have to find a way to get in so they don't realize what you're doing. And my way, since I couldn't get in as a writer, was to get in as a reader and then become a writer.
So you did ultimately become a writer at Universal.
I became a writer at other studios.
At other studios.
From Universal, I went to Fox. Began reading books that they thought Daryl Zanuck, who was then running a studio, would become interested in. And again, I kept writing my own stories and finally selling.
And but I see in the credits here that some of your films are certainly well known. I mean, Easter Parade.
That was a little later, yeah. Annie Get Your Gun, Easter Parade. I've done 30 movies. But I was in the Air Force first. I wrote 3 Broadway plays when I was 25 and still in uniform. And then went back to Hollywood with an original story that I had written called Suddenly It's Spring. And I sold it to David Selznick. He changed the title to The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer. And I said to him, Mr. Selznick, sir, no one is going to see a movie called The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer. It played Radio City Music Hall, made a fortune for him, got me an Oscar. That's how much I know about the business.
I imagine, though, somewhere in your mind, you were thinking that even though I'm having some success in writing these screenplays, if a book is going to be mine, because I would assume, not knowing that much about screenwriting, that they take screenplays and, in effect, decimate them. Other people work on them, and directors change them, and actors change them. But a story that you write for yourself that's published is yours.
It had never occurred to me in my life to write a book. People say to me, isn't it wonderful you fulfilled your fondest fantasy, you're a novelist. Never thought I could write a novel. It was sheer accident. I had created a show called I Dream of Jeannie, and I wrote all those scripts for 5 years. While I was doing that, I got an idea about a psychiatrist whom someone was trying to murder. And it intrigued me, but I didn't know how to do it in the dramatic form because you had to know what the protagonist was thinking. It was very introspective. The only way I could conceive of doing it was as a novel where you could tell the reader. And I liked the idea enough so I decided to try to write a novel. That's the only reason I ever got into being a novelist. And when I finished writing it, I called Irving Wallace, who's a dear friend, and I said, what do I do with this manuscript? I knew all of the Hollywood agents, but I didn't know any of the literary agents in New York. And he sent me to his agent. About 4 or 5 publishers turned the book down. William Morrow bought it through the editor there named Hillel Black, who's now head of Macmillan. And they published it. And I think it broke records. It was the only novel published, as far as I know, that sold 3 copies. My mother bought a copy, my brother bought one, and the cousin bought one.
That was The Naked Face?
The Naked Face. New York Times called it the best first mystery of the year. It's now up to about 4 million copies in softcover, but that's because of my other books. At any rate, I had such a feeling of freedom writing a novel without having an actor saying, I'm sorry, you'll have to change the lines, I can't read them that way. And a director saying we're going to play it in the mountains, not in the valley. Musicians creating moods with their music. All these people are collaborators, even if one writes alone. And I love that feeling of freedom, of not having anyone second-guessing me, no sponsors telling me what I could say or not say. So I sat down to write a second novel, just because of that. And I had no expectation that the second novel would be any more financially successful than The Naked Face. And my second book was called The Other Side of Midnight. And it literally changed my life. That's how I became a novelist. Sheer accident.
How did your life change?
I think the main way it changed was in recognition. I directed a picture with Cary Grant. I wrote it, produced it, directed it. Cary and I would be having lunch, and someone would come up and say, "Mr. Grant, I loved your movie." And that's the way it should have been, really, because the stars were out front. No one knew who was in back of the camera. If you walk down the street now and ask people who wrote whatever hit picture is playing in any theater in this town, they won't know who wrote it. They won't know who directed it. If it's a Neil Simon play, they will recognize Simon's name, but very few other playwrights, very few directors. Suddenly I found that I was a star, because when you write a novel, the reader who may be caught up in it and love it isn't going to write to the publisher and say, "You printed it beautifully." There is no one else. The novelist, any novelist, is the whole cast and the director and the producer. And he creates or she creates moods with words instead of music. And it's a very heady experience. So for the first time in my life, I got a totally different kind of recognition and an awareness of how much pleasure people got from what I was doing. If several million people went to see a movie that I had written, whether it was Annie Get Your Gun or Easter Parade or Jumbo, I never knew about their pleasure, ever. But I get a lot of fan mail about my books, and it's a wonderful feeling to have that link between myself and the readers out there. I'm published in 30 countries, and wherever I go in the world, I have people coming up to me very warmly and very gratefully. That gives me a wonderful feeling. That's the big difference.
Well, I'm sure that's the case, and you are certainly a publishing phenomenon. Do you do it all yourself, and do you have hire a staff of researchers to help you? Do you do everything yourself?
I do everything myself, yes. I start out never with a plot, but with a character. And when I have that character, for instance, in Rage of Angels, I decide I want to write about a female criminal lawyer. I met with Louis Neiser, Mel Belli, F. Lee Bailey, the top criminal lawyers in the country, went to the district attorney's office here, went to Rikers Island, went inside the prison, talked to prisoners. I do all that research. And if there was a scene I heard about that happened in Singapore, something that happened at midnight, every midnight, they would close up the shops, and the most beautiful women in the world would walk down the main street. The police would keep everyone on the sidewalks. They would sit at sidewalk cafes. And these women would walk down the street and talk to the men seated at these little cafes and make deals with them. They were prostitutes. And they weren't women. They were men. They were transvestites and beautiful. I heard about this, and I flew to Singapore so I could see it for myself and write about it. I didn't want to do it secondhand.
Who was the character that launched Windmills of the Gods?
The story of a woman ambassador. That's all I had. I wanted to write about a woman ambassador. I loved writing about women who are attractive, capable, interesting, and as good at their job as any man would be, because I know women like that, and I'm tired of the cliche about the dumb blondes. So I like writing about women who are all those things and who retain their femininity, which I think is very important. So I wanted to write about an ambassador who eventually, with very little experience, became very good at her job. And as I got into that character, it seemed to me that it would be interesting to put her in an Iron Curtain country. And I chose Romania. So I went to Romania. I spent 10 days there, spent time with the ambassador, the then ambassador. When I was there, was a man named Funderburk. And I was seated in his office at the embassy, and I said, "I would like to ask you a question." And he got to his feet, and he said, "Follow me." And he led me down a maze of corridors into a Star Wars room guarded by a Marine. It was the only room in the American embassy in Bucharest that could not be bugged. And he said, "What do you want to know?" And I said, "Do you think my hotel room is bugged?" And he said, "Mr. Sheldon, you can rest assured that not only is your hotel room bugged, But if you go to dinner at a restaurant, your table will be bugged. Two nights later, my wife and I went up to the restaurant upstairs in a hotel. They seated us at a table, and the air conditioning bothered me, and I moved us to another table. The manager came running over and put us back at the original table, which amused me because I knew what was going on. The following day, I had lunch at the residence of the ambassador. There were about six of us at lunch. And I said, I would like to ask you a question. And he got up, and he said, why don't we go for a walk in the garden? Every room in the American residence was bugged, and only Romanians could work there. You couldn't have an American work in the residence. And all these men and women worked for the security, the secret police of Romania. So that was a fascinating experience. But I couldn't have written about it without being there and living it.
I hope you didn't have to send your shoes out to be rehealed.
No, but that came from a true story. One of the members of the embassy sent her shoes out to be repaired. And they found that someone was bugging these secret meetings. And they traced it down to her shoe. And I used that in Windmills of the Gods.
How do you order your life, your working life, when you started writing this book? It seems to me that all the threads were pulled together. I don't think there are any dangling ends here.
I hope not.
So, but you must start by organizing yourself extremely well so you know that you're going to have a beginning, a middle, an end, and this sort of thing, pull everything together.
I do it differently, and the way I work is not a way I would recommend to any young writer, because I've been at it a long time, and it takes a lot of experience. I have no plot at all in mind, only the character. And I dictate to a secretary. I dictate my first drafts. I start talking. I will have perhaps three notes on a piece of paper. And from those three notes, I'll dictate for 4 hours. As I talk, the characters come to life, and the story starts to come to life. And at the end of the day, she will type the pages. My secretary will type the pages. And I will see scenes and characters there that I didn't know existed that morning when I began. And I will go through to the end of the book, and that can be 1,000 to 1,500 pages. And it's really all ad-lib, all talk, and it just comes from the characters as I speak. And when I have the first draft down, all typed, I go to page one, and I start revising it. I will throw out 100 or 200 pages at a time.
Do you revise verbally at this point?
No. I take the typed pages, and I cross out things, throw pages right on the back of the pages, and give it to my secretary, and she types up a clean new script. And when I'm through going through it, which may take 2 or 3 months, I go back to page one, and I do that for a year to a year and a half, just revising it over and over and over, and I'll do up to 12 drafts. Now, if I did it right the first time, I wouldn't have to do any of that. But I keep working on it and refining it, and that's when the ends get pulled together, so there are no loose ends. But it takes all that time.
Well, when the manuscript goes off tomorrow to the editor, what happens then? Do you work closely with the editor, or is it pretty well in shape by then?
It's ready to be published. What they do, they come to me instead of my sending the manuscript off, because every publisher has people working there who will make 100 or 200 a week running mimeograph machines. And the studios pay them to slip them copies of bootleg manuscripts. If something comes in that's hot, they want copies of it immediately. So in order to avoid that, my publishers have come to see me in Rome. I live there for a year. In London, where I live for a year. And in my house in California, they've come there a couple times. On Windmills of the Gods, we all flew to Monte Carlo, and they read it in Monte Carlo. But I don't let the manuscript out of my hands.
What a nice place. What a place to hide, Monte Carlo.
It is.
That's great. Do you always have a project, or after you finish your book, do you go through a stage where you just kind of rest up and not do anything?
I'm working on a new book now, and I'll be going to Spain later in the year to do research for that. And again, all I have is a character. I start with that, and the story will come, I hope, when I begin talking. I say I hope because we can't control creativity. I think it's something given to us. I did two movies with Irving Berlin, and I will never forget him telling me one day that his greatest fear was that he would wake up one morning and never be able to write another song, because we really can't control that power.
I've heard of burnout and people who had, like Dashiell Hammett, wrote these wonderful mysteries and then one day stopped writing, never wrote again. It is a very hard thing to measure, creativity. Nobody knows what happens. And why it stops and why it flourishes. It is. It's almost as mysterious as the origin of matter.
That's true, and we don't know about the origin of matter. I want to know where matter came from originally.
I told you.
You think it was always there. I can't accept that. Anyway, creativity is very, very strange, totally unpredictable. Margaret Mitchell wrote one book and never another one. Alan Lerner had such wonderful successes and toward the end of his life had three or four plays that either didn't get on or closed in a night or two. And that's a shame. But we are at the mercy of that and we have to be grateful for whatever talent we're given. And we have to work very hard at that talent.
What's it like being a celebrity? Most writers don't become celebrities. In fact, many of them are academics, and they write little books and little stories, or at least they try writing. Nobody pays any attention or hears. They have a very low sale. Here you have these blockbusters, and your name is so well known. So mention on the way in that sometimes you use a pseudonym when you travel. Is that right?
Well, I don't usually have to do that. You know, Kirk Douglas is an old friend of mine. I wrote a Broadway play. The first play he was ever in, I wrote many years ago. And we've been friends for a long time. And I was having drinks with him and Louis Jourdan one day. And Kirk was saying, "Isn't it wonderful you've become so famous now?" And my answer was that I'm famous in a different way. There is nowhere in the world that Kirk Douglas or Louis Jourdan can go anonymously. And in a way, that's a curse, because sometimes you want privacy. And they can never have privacy when they're out. My kind of fame is wonderful because most people don't recognize my face. So unless they hear my name, I'm totally anonymous. So I can have it really both ways. And it's a great joy. One of the most touching things that ever happened to me was when I had been in the hospital with pneumonia. And the day I got out, I had a new book out, and I wanted just to see how it was doing in the bookstores. And I went into a bookstore feeling rather weak. And I said to the manager, "I'm Sidney Sheldon." The reason I did that is I never say, "How is so-and-so selling?" And if he says badly, then I embarrass him by saying, "I'm Sidney Sheldon." So I said, "I'm Sidney Sheldon." I was going to ask him about my book. There were about 8 customers standing around. And they turned to me and started to applaud. And I started to cry. I mean, it was very touching. So I love the contact with people who I seem to have given a lot of pleasure. And that gives me enormous pleasure.
Well, you certainly have given your readers enormous pleasure, and they will not be disappointed with Windmills of the Gods. It was terrific having the chance to talk to you. Incidentally, I was just to throw out a little anecdote that Roy Blunt is a humorist who's written a number of books, and he likes to go into a bookstore and see how his book is doing, just as you did. But his observation is that a watched book never sells.
He may be right.
Just answer all day and nobody will buy it. Sidney Sheldon, thank you very, very much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.